So you're you're saying four boxes of Oreos a year, and you're telling me that you consume four boxes of Thin Mints a year also?
Yes. Hello, hello. Welcome to another round of the Sophisticates. I'm Matt Patches, and with me again, my two lovely life partners, Rajan Mudambi.
Hello.
Hey. Yeah, that, yes, enthusiasm. And Ryan Pfister, who may or may not have just woken up from a nap.
Just phoning it in.
Oh, you know, you gotta get the blood pumping, dude.
Does this mean that I can get a discount at your place of work or New York benefits?
Oh, yes, now it does. But where you are, no. You'd have to move to.
Are you allowed to have two life partners?
Who knows? I feel like anything goes now.
Only if you want to be discriminatory against polygamists.
Yes, but
yes,
we
and
do,
I would never do that.
I'm pretty sure it's illegal.
We're chipper, we're ready to go with another slate of topics, so we might as well dive right in for our first topic today. Tolls!
Over the past month, I guess 3 months really, I have been driving back and forth to Pittsburgh, and so I've been paying a lot of tolls on the turnpike. And I also had to pay some tolls when I went up to New York. And I've been also reading about tolls as a kind of smarter transportation initiative.
Reading about tolls? Where do you do that?
On, like, Governing Magazine and all the other, like, kind of, like,
Government Magazine.
Yeah, you know, Governing Magazine, Government Executive Magazine, Government
These
Computer
sound like
News.
Magazines that, like, Jack Donaghy would be reading, / made up for 30 Rock.
Yes.
I guess I kind of came around agreeing with some of these government analyst dudes that tolls are actually a pretty efficient system, because I guess I felt like I really paid my fair share for the roads that I was using.
So you're all about tolls.
I kind of came away like they were sort of annoying because they slow you down as long as they're not congesting at the toll plazas. And I also came away, I really liked the concept of the tolls that were marginal and that you only pay, like on the turnpike, you only pay for what you actually use. I hate the tolls on 95 where you pay like $5 just out of the blue for like crossing the end of a bridge after
sure.
a while.
Yeah, no, totally. And New York is having the same problem. I mean, I know a lot of people who drive who are furious with New York because the tolls for the bridges are becoming astronomical, you know, like above $10.
So you just got to know which bridges to cross.
Yeah, but you don't go out of your way. You can't.
Depends how militant you are anti-toll.
No, yeah, I've gone out of my way. Well, I guess with a bridge, it's probably tougher. But I've definitely, like, I have a whole science how I can get back from D.C. without paying.
Yeah, my uncle does that, too.
But that takes so much longer. I mean, you might.
That's the key to the good toll avoidance route. It doesn't take longer. Or you figure out your like hourly rate that you're willing to pay to avoid a toll.
I mean, I don't drive enough that it really impacts me, and I think that's more and more why New York can get away raising its tolls without too much fury coming in its direction. You know, we don't drive that much, and it's a good way to encourage people not to. You know, if there's any sort of deterrent to the amount of traffic, it's tolls. They're the best way to lower people from actually getting around. But I think at a certain point, people are going to be so fed up that you'll see more and more people speed through the tolls. Danger will increase because of how pissed off people will get with tolls.
If you have Easy Pass, it really doesn't take much time.
Yeah, but you think more people would be involved with Easy Pass. They're not. You see so many people still without Easy Pass. How long has Easy Pass been
around? You're
right. Ten years, maybe?
Yeah, there was all. That's true.
I don't have Easy Pass.
What are they doing?
I don't want the man to know exactly where I've gone and the fact that I've driven far too fast down the road.
Wait, seriously? Is that the reason you don't have Easy Pass? Because you're afraid of, like, Big Brother?
No, I'm just too lazy to get Easy Pass. That's really what it is.
It's
You're
true.
Too lazy.
The man would know, like, because that happens on like probably 25% of Law and Order episodes.
That Easy Pass catches them in the middle of a crime.
Well, they know. They're like, we know you came into the city.
I think if you don't drive on toll roads that often, it somehow doesn't feel like it's worth the hassle because you're like, well.
Well, I guess it can go either way.
What do you mean?
Well, I guess the question is, how could you make people get this Easy Pass? I guess they think that they drive so infrequently that they're just not gonna bother with it.
I mean, that's kind of how I feel about it.
But have you gone out of your way not to pay them?
Yeah, I have sometimes.
Because now I'm now thinking about what Ryan said earlier about trying to find routes that avoid the toll booths. But I wonder if as they go up too, you know, I my conjecture was that people would speed through them and commit crimes, but I should give humanity as a whole more credit. And I think people will do what Ryan does and avoid toll booths. But then won't that actually divert mass amounts of traffic to more suburban areas, places that don't need that extra traffic? You'll ruin life in smaller towns because you're pushing people away from highways.
I don't think that many people
actually, I would argue that a small amount of toll avoidance is actually what you want, because you want people making that trade-off. You know, you want people looking at it and saying, oh, you know, if a toll is set exactly right, like, you'll have a very minimal amount of doing that.
Like, but I think, like, it's going to come to a point where it's like, oh, the highways are for the upper middle class now.
Well, I guess you see a little bit of that. So a toll that I know of that is very marginal, like, you don't have to use it, is in D.C. Well, actually, it's in Virginia. It's the Dulles Toll Road. And... or I guess it's the Dulles Greenway, I think, actually, going out even farther into the rich Loudoun County area. And you could take local roads out into Loudoun County, or you could pay this super expensive toll. And so that's a toll that it's primarily, I think, I mean, you have to have the income in order to take that toll.
So it's basically a rich person's road.
I see roads becoming that.
The thing that concerns me about tolls is, I guess the thing that appeals me, it's not necessarily the toll per se, it's paying only the marginal cost of the roads that not just marginal cost, but paying only for the roads they actually drive. I have no confidence in our current system that that's actually what happening. That is actually what is happening. Like, driving on the turnpike, I think the turnpike is in many cases just a way to fund all the other roads in Pennsylvania. It's all this turnpike.
Wait,
money.
So you're saying we need to charge people for other roads?
Well, I think it's just. It's ideal to charge people that drive a lot, and it's also ideal to have these roads be free. I think that having the two worlds exist at the same time definitely creates some issues.
I mean, at the end of the day, the roads do have to be paid for somehow.
But I think there's a tipping point, a ripple effect that will be caused by pushing it over a certain limit. And when you start increasing the tolls of the big roads and people... scatter to the smaller areas.
I mean, an example of this is in the Dulles Toll Road part, where, okay, so I was trying to drive to the office one time, and I could drive farther and avoid having to pay the exit toll, but the extra 10 minutes of gas would cost basically the same amount as the toll. So I think that the toll is set very well. You basically have it cost equal to the amount of lost time and gas that you'll have going another route.
I don't think people are as calculated as you are.
Well,
I don't think so either.
It depends on if they're commuting it, like, are they doing it every day, or is it like a one-time deal?
Most people drive to and fro places every day.
I think, generally speaking, people don't really plan out the exact route that they're going to drive that in depth. I feel like, in general, these toll roads tend to be kind of throughways that were... like, you take this road if you're trying to go... take, like, the NJ Turnpike if you're trying to go from Philadelphia to New York, you know? You're going a significant distance, generally speaking, when you take these toll roads.
And that's what's interesting, because, you know, so state taxes and federal highway funds, I think, fund most of the other roads in a state. And so what's interesting is that we have these throughways, and, you know, you obviously will have a lot of tourists or interstate travelers paying these tolls. And in that sense, it's very, you know, it's fair that they're paying this toll because they're not paying these state taxes. Mm. But on the other hand, you're basically making them, through these higher toll costs, pay for other roads in the state. You know, like, they're basically subsidizing roads in the state that they're not driving on.
It's a tourist tax.
Yeah, it's like those freaking hotel taxes, you know, that are...
But it's 20%. Not even like a tourist, but in a lot of cases, it's not even, I'm not even trying to be a tourist in your state. I'm trying to pass through your state to go be a tourist somewhere else.
Yeah, you should get out of it free.
Maybe there should be a VAT refund. Like how a lot of countries have a VAT refund, I think, in Europe. If you like took it out of the country or something, you can get a small part of the tax back.
But I guess it's pointless. if it's meant to fund something, you can't give it back.
I don't know. It's just a dichotomy, you know, you're funding the road, which I think is fair, but then you're also using it to fund other roads, which I think is a little more sketch.
I don't think we'll ever be conscious enough about the extent that tolls pay for things. we'll always be just angry about that one value that we see as we drive up to it. And at a certain point, it'll push people away from the highways, and chaos! It will create chaos! Why don't we move on to our second topic for tonight? Professional street photographs.
I got this topic from a friend of mine, Adrian. And basically, she was saying, she lives in New York, was saying that she's often, she's struck by the fact that how often she's, when she's walking down the streets in Manhattan, where you'll just see someone standing, posing by the side of like some building with some person taking a professional-looking photograph of them. And it happens enough that you just kind of wonder, who are all these people and why do they need these pictures? And why are they posing against buildings?
Well, like, New York is a weird epicenter for random professional photography for a number of reasons. One, I think it's because there's a lot of photographers here. Two, I think it's because there's a lot of actors here getting, like, headshots.
Yeah, but these aren't headshots. These are people leaning against buildings.
That's what headshots are. You should see headshots. It's like standing next to brick and smiling in regular daylight. These aren't Sears family photo sort of headshots in a studio. These are out and about, getting real in the city.
When did that become a headshot? Is this the new headshot?
I thought a headshot
now?
Was a shot of a head.
Yeah, it's a shot of a head stylized. Against like a brick wall or like on a stoop. They're trying to make them into real people. You gotta be real now.
I thought you were supposed to look all made up and pretty in a headshot.
Well, you are made up, but now you're doing it on the street. You're part of the city. I think if you're an actor in the city, then you want to be like in it, you know, in it to win it.
As opposed to like an actor from the burbs, and then you're against the Sears Roebuck blue fade background.
But then there's this, like this weird third category of people who get their pictures taken around town, and it's people getting married. I just see more and more people, like especially in Central Park, or just around the street there. I don't know why that's appropriate.
So are you saying that just like people are getting married at Central Park, or in the area around Central Park, and they like leave their chapel or wherever they're getting married, and they just get photographed outside?
I'm just saying the wedding seems like a really formal event, and a lot of the very few weddings that I've been to have been in kind of a private location so that everyone can have this big party and take all these pictures and make it really nice. But if you do it in the city, around the streets, it's like you're there surrounded by all these people and you're trying to take these nice pictures, and it doesn't really make sense. And I kind of, piggybacking off that with the idea of doing your headshots right in the middle of the street, it's like, why would anyone want any sort of professional photograph taken on the streets of New York, or any city for that matter, just like where other people go? It doesn't seem ideal for any kind of photograph.
So you want your photography location to deliver an air of exclusivity?
Yes, I think that increases the elegance of a photograph.
So, like, what is a good photograph location for you? Like, Mount Olympus?
Mount Olympus? Is like, that even a real place? That's where gods live.
Augusta National, perhaps?
What is Augusta National?
It's a golf course.
It's a very exclusive golf club. I'm trying to think of exclusive
places.
Well,
no, because I don't think that's a very scenic place. I mean, I'm sure it looks nice in a very trim, proper way. The best photographs of cities and streets are in motion and capturing energy. But what kind of professional street or professional photographs do you want that kind of feel?
I mean, I think that this is probably a symptom of the larger vast overweighting by our society, or I think it's just in everybody's psyche of New York's coolness factor, just
it's always
kind
about
of
coolness.
Existential to New York.
Wait, what do you mean? Be like,
I don't know if I've talked about this before, but like when I lived in New York for a summer, and then like thinking back on it now, I vastly overweight how cool it was. Like I think about the time that I bought some goldfish at a like Pepperidge Farm at a corner store and like walked down the street eating them, and I was like, whoa, that's cool. Like that was not anywhere remotely cool, but because it was in New York, for some reason I think it is cool.
But and you don't think it's cool anymore?
Objectively, it is not.
I would agree with Pfister in that, like, the most mundane things in New York can seem like awesome because they're in New York, like a subway sign, for example, or just like a corner deli or something.
Sure.
These are just like very normal things that you have in every, not every city, but not every city has a subway, but like they're all over the place. You have these things, but this is, you know, in New York, you know.
I wonder if I've lost my perspective a little bit more than I thought I have. You know, I still have, and I'm glad that I do, because that's why I can continue to live here. But like the idea of, and I get this feeling, I specifically get this feeling when I walk down Madison Avenue, Midtown, at night, cool breeze, like I'm walking down New York, there's the MetLife building, and there's traffic everywhere, and like, New York, wow. But I have that feeling a lot less. It's just kind of like the place I live that has a lot to offer me. But maybe, and tell me if I'm wrong about what you're saying here, is that people might be interested in taking professional photos on the streets because there's some sort of magic there, that when they see that later, they're going to remember the feeling of being there. I guess that's what great photographs are.
Yeah, I think that's probably, yeah, that's part of it. I think especially if that's what they're going for. Like, if, I mean, we talked about if they want to have this kind of like gritty on the street feel. I mean, I guess the question is, I think for the comparison here, is it's like, okay, I have to take a photograph of, I have to get a photograph taken of me. I could take it on the street of New York, or I could take it on the streets of Wilmington.
Well, like, I'm not even on the streets. I mean, think if you were getting your picture taken for the back of the cover of a book that you wrote. Would you do that shot in the middle of the city? Or would you do that, you know, on the back porch of some house in the country?
Depends on the book, right?
Yeah, if it was like a book about urban decline in the age of austerity or something.
Okay, I know what the book's about, but you're not getting a themed picture here. You're trying to present yourself as this elegant person.
No.
A sophisticated person, if you will.
It depends on the book.
Well, now we're getting super specific.
It really does.
Specific,
it,
but
it depends on if you're writing about, like, for an audience that is like kind of a rustic sort of audience, then obviously you're not going to do that on the streets of New York. But if you're trying to come off as kind of like member of the American intelligentsia or something like that, then that
sounds terrifying.
I feel like having your picture taken in New York is probably a good route to go.
Yeah, but not on the streets. Maybe in the loft overlooking the skyline. We're talking about on the street.
This isn't
just like friends snapping photos of each other. We're talking about a professional photo. Or like, think of some, what instance in your life would you get a professional photo taken?
Up to now, I've had professional photos taken of me for like passports and in high school.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
Those are the only photos I've ever had. So
what separates them from snapshots?
You might use them like for something other than Facebook.
Right, and that's when I start getting at, like, these are pictures that you want to last longer, like that you want to be able to show people in any setting. You know, Facebook photos are the kind of, they're so casual, but you wouldn't go around saying, like, this is the best photo of me. So would you want the best photo of you to be, like, in the middle of a street?
Yeah, if you wanted to look back and think how cool you were, especially if you kind of had, like, some kind of inferiority complex. Or you were really trying to think of yourself as really cool or like on the streets, or you were going to try to make it in New York one day.
There are a lot of cool things in New York, whether they be like graffiti art or murals or interesting looking buildings or doorsteps or whatever, that maybe that's what's grabbing you, not just the idea of I'm on the streets of New York, man.
I mean, that's what photography is all about, obviously capturing a mood within a still frame. But I think, you know, when what you're describing, Raja, and I see off the beaten track in outer boroughs, I don't see, you know, in the middle of Times Square
trying to
take a professional photo.
Well,
like, can you imagine getting your wedding photos in the middle of, like, in front of the Lion King?
Well, dude, everybody would know you were faking. Gosh.
Times Square,
you're clueless at that point.
but, I mean, do people get their professional photos taken in Times Square?
I think there are some people who do.
You're
definitely trying to say something different than if you're getting. I mean, there's a diversity within the people who are getting their professional photos taken in New York, which is probably not surprising given how diverse New York is.
Right. I guess at the end of the day, it's about forethought, you know? Just know the people that want to do it either don't realize what they're getting themselves into and what the end result of that photo will have, the kind of energy and mood behind it, or they do, and that's what they're going for in the first place, and that's why there's so many people who do it, because they want to capture this one magical moment in the city or anywhere where they are. I mean, whatever aura they're experiencing. And that's why there's so many professional street photographs going on.
Yeah,
plus actors and headshots.
I enjoyed how this topic was basically like a proxy topic for the jadedness of Matt Patches about New York.
Oh, it's every topic on the Sophisticates is a mirror on my life and how horrible it is. Anyway, why don't we move on to our third and final topic for today? Why we don't get Girl Scout cookies year round. So this comes from an obvious yearning for something that I love, which is Thin Mints. I think we can all agree that Thin Mints are one of the greatest inventions of mankind, at least in the last 1,000 years. And
Caramel Delights are better.
What are Caramel Delights? Or I also don't know, what are the name of the ones with the peanut butter and the chocolate and the wafer in the middle? Anyway, the point is, we all have our favorite Girl Scout cookies, but we can only get them at a certain point of the year, and that's starting to bother me in a way that has never bothered me before. And I don't know if it's because the little things in life are becoming more important, or I am just so sad with my life that I need to eat it away with Girl Scout cookies, whatever that may be. I don't understand why the Girl Scouts aren't making 1,000 times more bank than they normally are by just selling Girl Scout cookies all the time.
Well,
I mean, you could if you bought enough of them.
But then they go stale. They're not designed. No food is designed for you to hoard, I don't think, except for maybe Spam. And I don't think the Girl Scouts sell that.
Look, I think that the big limiting factor here is the fact that these Girl Scouts are, like, the Girl Scouts doing the selling, it's not a full-time gig for them. Like, the Girl Scouts ramping up in their troop to go sell these cookies is, like, a big undertaking. You know, it's what they do for, like, that.
Yeah, but don't you
think
they could balance it better? I mean, does it, it if they sold them all year round, it wouldn't have to be, you know, like, their full-time push for a season. It would just be something they do on the side. And then, you know, every couple weeks you have to do Girl Scout cookie duty at the local market or something. It just doesn't become the emphasis anymore, and it's just a year-long thing funneling money into the organization.
I think fundamentally, I mean, you could just buy a Thin Mint knockoff cookie. They would taste just as good.
No.
But you don't.
Of course I can't do that. That's not true. We know they're not as good. We've all tried this. It is not true.
Well, I think maybe it's a question purely of time invested. Because if you had to sell the Girl Scout cookies every week, I think it'd be I would definitely be less likely to buy the Girl Scout cookies on any particular occasion. But, like, right now, if I go to the grocery store and I see somebody selling Girl Scout cookies, I'm probably going to buy the Girl Scout cookies. Because who knows?
Because you know they're not
going to
last.
Back,
right.
You know?
Well, I guess that's, you know, the first rule of show business. Always leave them wanting more. So I wonder, I guess that the limited time only ploy is for that, is to feed our addiction.
Well, I mean, I think the goal here is, I mean, frankly, look, like, we've already talked about Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts here. Like, the people doing this often have some disposable income to begin with, and they value the time of having to shuttle their kids to these fundraisers sometimes more than they value having to shell another $50 check. So if you had to do something every week versus, like, you just show up, like, maybe 3 times, you sell the Girl Scout cookies, you sell a whole bunch of Girl Scout cookies, maybe less than you would selling them every week, but still a lot, I think that's probably more valuable.
I guess the other question is that I guess Patches didn't mention, but why the Girl Scouts could sell their cookies in a different form, in a different medium than just having the Girl Scouts themselves sell them. I mean, they have the cookies, so the Girl Scouts organization, they could, during the off season, when the Girl Scouts themselves are not selling the cookies, they could broker a deal with some grocery stores maybe, and let them stock a certain amount of them to just kind of tide people over till the Girl Scouts come back and sell the actual girls are going around selling cookies again. They could do that.
I think that defeats the purpose that Ryan's talking about. that they need some sort of break, right, Ryan?
Yeah, they don't want to have to do it every week.
Do you think that by any sort of limited time marketing, and Girl Scout cookies is a perfect example of this, but are we feeding a bad addiction here in some ways? Do we make our rabid feasting of Girl Scout cookies from X point to Y point in a year, is that bad for people? If they're around all the time, would we eat them less? Would we care about them less? And is that more important? And does that...
Are you trying to bring in the obesity epidemic here? But, I mean, the question is, these Girl Scout cookies, like, do you think you really consume net more Girl Scout cookies than you would if they were there all the time?
Well, it's hard for me to say because in New York, it's very difficult to get Girl Scout cookies. I have to smuggle them in from suburbanites. And have
Wait, there's no Girl Scout troops in New York selling the cookies?
I cannot find the cookies anywhere.
Living in the burbs, maybe it's just there's just a plethora of cookies. I guess I don't feel like I need the cookies all the time. I only eat them when they're... I guess I'm content just eating them when they're in demand.
I also think that if the Girl Scout cookies were around all year, they would just be another type of cookie. But
right,
the
they would de-emphasize
around,
them.
I think the fact that they're only sold... specific time of the year makes them somehow seem special.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, when they it's like Christmas time when Girl Scout cookies come. There's the Girl Scout cookie smell is in the air and we're all excited for them. But Ryan, you kind of touched on this, and maybe this is where I was going with it. You know, not the obesity factor, but the hunger factor, the things that we are rabid for when they come around. It doesn't seem like something we should be promoting. It doesn't seem like the thing that an organization like the Girl Scouts or any organization should depend on. You know, if they just sold them all year round, they'd probably make just as much money, just not all at once. And and it would be spread out, and it wouldn't seem like such a feasting.
I mean, I agree. There's a little bit of, like, irony there in an organization that, you know, physical fitness and health is one of the things that they promote. And they're trying to get everybody to feast on these cookies. Like, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I guess your thing is if you think if they... Well, but I'm still going to go back to this. I still don't think if you sold cookies year-round, I think you'd end up eating more cookies.
You think I would?
Yeah, they'd be there all the time.
I think you'd eat more Girl Scout cookies. I don't know. Would you necessarily eat more cookies?
But wouldn't I lose my lust for them? I think I would, probably. Like you said, Rajan, if they're there all the time, then they become less special. And that's what... Half of why they're so exciting is because they're only around for part of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd be going through Rite Aid. You'd be like, all right, got my gum, got my soda. Oh, give me some Girl Scout cookies.
Why not? They're there.
They're there.
Yeah.
I mean, you still like the Thin Mints by themselves. You know, like, I think you'd just... You just wouldn't even think about it.
But I don't think... I disagree, because there's other things that have been around all the time, and you don't need them. I mean, the things that you like, you're not addicted to them.
Patches, would you say that Thin Mints are your favorite cookie, period?
I think Tagalongs are my favorite. I think Tagalongs are the chocolate and... peanut butter ones. You know what? I'd have to say I'm an Oreo fan, too. So I don't know. I think you're right. I think
so,
it's the limited
so
time.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you don't go around buying Oreos every time you go to the grocery store, then you're probably not going to buy Girl Scout cookies every time you do that.
Right,
as well.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. That's why, Ryan, I'm not sure why
no,
you think that.
No, that's not a true metric, though. That's not a true... No, the question is the amount of Oreos that... Like, how many Oreo boxes do you think you consume... like on a monthly or yearly basis? Like
maybe one.
One per year?
No, maybe one. No, not one a month. I'd say one every 3 months.
One every
maybe.
3 months. So that is
which
four
is probably
boxes.
How many Girl Scout cookies I've eaten. How many boxes of Girl Scout cookies?
So you're wait. So you're saying four boxes of Oreos a year, and you're telling me that you consume four boxes of Thin Mints a year also?
Yes. Yes, I am saying that.
So I guess the question is, if the Oreos were really not there, like at a grocery store, you could only buy them in limited portions from unreliable vendors. a certain time of the year that you would actually consume more Oreos, that you would buy like 5 boxes of Oreos at that
if I could
point.
Only get them from a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And that's the thing. If I eat 4 packs of Oreos in a year and 4 boxes of Thin Mints in a year, realize that I'm eating 4 boxes of Thin Mints within the time that Girl Scout cookies are available.
I think there'd be shame. I think the shame would keep it down.
The shame of what?
Of eating 5 boxes of Oreos in the span of
like
2 months.
No, but see, you're not planning on eating them right then. You're like, okay, I can't buy them another time. I need to buy them now and just kind of like stock up.
Okay,
but then they're around.
The effect of the scarcity factor here.
I might disagree with
that.
I think
so.
If we're talking about them as a Girl Scout metaphor. Does that make sense?
No, with the Oreos. Yeah, it's just for comparison. I mean, Oreo is a good cookie, one that is readily available and also coveted by many. This seems to be calling out for some kind of experiment.
What do you love? Like, what is one of your favorite snacks?
One of my favorite snacks. I like Fritos.
Okay, you love Fritos. How many bags of Fritos do you go through?
Not that many. Like, maybe, like...
That's the thing. The things that we love that are readily available, we just don't do because they're
there.
Because
you always can.
Yeah, because you can
anytime.
It's
like when you live in New York, you never go to the top of the Empire State Building because it's right there.
But by limiting it to us and creating this hype that we gorge... People gorge. I mean, I literally, and I don't think I'm alone here, eat probably as many boxes of Girl Scout cookies as I do any other cookie, but over the extended part of the year, whereas the Girl Scout cookies, they go in a second. Because it's like, oh my god, they're back! And then you eat them all, and then you're fucking fat ass.
Well,
like
that was the argument I was making, is that you do have, I know you eat a lot in a short period of time with the Girl Scout cookies, but... You just have such a longer period that I think the two effects basically equal out.
I guess my fundamental disagreement is it's not good to eat that much of anything in that span of time.
So okay.
It cannot be good for you.
So all right, so that's an interesting perspective. So we're saying that all things, you know, even if you're going to eat 4 boxes of Girl Scout cookies over the course of the year, it would be better to space out that cookie consumption.
Yes, for your well-being and your mental state.
Now, couldn't you just do that anyway, having purchased the cookies at once? Well, they go stale.
Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But I think the bigger issue is you have cookies staring at you in your closet, in
That's
your cupboard,
exactly
right?
That's true. Yes, you're 100%.
That you eat them. They're
There's
there.
There's no way
they're
going
to
stay there.
You.
There's no way. You cannot hoard something delicious like cookies. Well, I think that about wraps things up. Fister, did you end up getting a haircut this week? What's the deal? I feel like it's been eons.
It's a... I don't know. It's a crisis because I was going to get a haircut, and then my girlfriend was like, no, I like the hair how it is.
Whoa.
And I was like, okay.
You bent over backwards for the lady.
This is kind of the Fisterian law here. Like, all things being equal, choose the option which is cheaper.
Fair enough.
On that note, that wraps up another episode of the Sophisticates. You know where to find us. We're on Twitter at Sophisticast. We're on Tumblr, thesophisticates.tumblr.com. We're, of course, on iTunes, where you should be listening to us. Subscribe. You just have to search for The Sophisticates, and you will find us. We're a podcast. We're wonderful. And now we will talk to you later. Goodbye.